This is Audible.
Reagan's Star Wars, written by Walter Parks. Your narrator is Rich Germain. President Eisenhower led us to victory in World War II. He then led our country as president for 8 years. He understood war, and he understood how Washington worked. The major message he gave us as he left the presidency was, "Beware of the military-industrial complex." His warning was very appropriate, but it was not heeded by our nation. I know, because I not only witnessed it being ignored, but I participated in using the power of the military-industrial complex during my aerospace career. This book describes why and how the power of the military-industrial complex gave birth to the Strategic Defense Initiative known as Star Wars. Now some words of introduction. Hitler was defeated. The atom bomb ended the conflict with Japan. But peace did not break out. The Cold War between the U.S. and Russia prevented real peace. It had started even before World War II ended. It would last until the USSR failed and split into many countries in 1991. Some would say that it still continues, but at perhaps a less threatening level. By the early 1980s, it was becoming clear that the USSR would fail. The major U.S. aerospace companies who were dependent on military spending were growing concerned that peace would be declared and the military budgets would be significantly decreased. They had to do something. Most of the major U.S. aerospace companies maintained a study staff to assess military needs and likely budget actions, and of course, to try to influence such actions and budgets. I know the details of the Martin Marietta Aerospace Company's studies and the resulting pitches to the military, Congress, NATO, and all affected agencies, including the president, because I was a corporate vice president and well aware of our studies. I also had some awareness of such studies at Lockheed Aerospace Company, because we had a close relationship with them. The two companies eventually merged, and is now Lockheed Martin Aerospace Company. Their studies viewed the sharp drops in military budgets at the end of military threats, like World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. They feared that peace would break out and the budgets would be significantly decreased, maybe even as severe as happened after World War II. President Carter had already dropped the budget to the lowest it had been in over 25 years. The U.S. military budgets would certainly be decreased. What could the aerospace giants do to continue our enriched lifestyles? They reasoned that seeking funds for new weapons in a peacetime or seeking funds to patch existing weapons would not result in the magnitude of budgets that they needed. They put a study together that showed the merits of pursuing a leapfrog to the current weapons technology and jumping into technology of the future. They started preaching such a strategy to the U.S. military, to Congress, to the President, NATO, and any agency that would listen. The pitch got honed until it began to make sense. The Strategic Defense Initiative, later known as Star Wars, was about to be born. Chapter 1. Save the Military Budget. We honed our pitches first with the military staffs in the Pentagon, then the staffers of the key military committees in Congress. Then we were ready for the president. I remember a key pitch to the president that I believe really convinced him in the merits of pursuing a leapfrog to current technology. It was more about nature than military weapons. We told him about the tiny leaf cutters. There are several varieties of these insects. They cut near-perfect round holes in leaves and take the cutouts to their nests. The small leaf cutter bee removes these leaf cutouts and leaves holes in the leaf that look as if they were cut by a precision machine. The bees roll up the leaf cutouts and fly them to their nests, where the leaf circlets are used to line the bees' nest cells. We pointed out how all of this precision information is coded in the tiny brain of the tiny insect. We made it clear that if the military could fund leapfrog technology, that we could develop tiny military control systems that could contain all the information that any future battlefield commander could ever need. The president got the point. We did not initially pitch any specific military program. We concentrated on basic research for understanding the potential for future military technology. We discussed how electronics could be packaged in extremely small spaces and how we could eliminate the cooling systems that were taking up more space and cost than the basic electronics in our current missile systems and especially in our space projects. We described how we could use infrared technology and multiple spectrum technologies to detect the enemy in all forms at great distances. We also showed how this technology could help us design our systems so the enemy could not detect us. We described how we could use the entire electromagnetic spectrum for such detection and for making stealth versions of our own weapon systems. We discussed ionic propulsion systems that could allow our space systems to travel over the great distances that would be needed for future space operations. Such propulsion systems would require almost no energy compared to the systems of the day. President Reagan was sold. The military budgets ceased the Carter decline and began to rise. The military-industrial complex was working. The military budgets were saved. President Reagan was indeed sold on the need for technology advancement in the military. He significantly increased the budget to almost the level of the Vietnam War. But then, pressures built to lower it, and later President Clinton ordered significant decreases to achieve his remarkable decreases in the national debt. But the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower had warned us about in his departing speech from the presidency worked with President Bush and got the budgets back to an astounding level of $644 billion in 2005 dollars. The military-industrial complex again won the day. Chapter 2, The Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI. President Reagan absorbed and understood our pitches and proposed a new program, the Strategic Defense Initiative, or SDI, on March 23, 1983. It was to replace the insane old strategic plan of mutual assured destruction, also known as MAD, that had been in place for many years. The president's proposal was accepted by the military and Congress, and SDI was set up in the Pentagon in 1984. The ambitious initiative was widely criticized as being unrealistic, even unscientific. Many feared that it would be destabilizing to the long-established MAD philosophy that had worked for years, and that it would reignite an offensive arms race. Dr. Carol Rosen, a consultant and former spokeswoman for Wernher von Braun, may have been the first to dub SDI as Star Wars. However, historians attribute the term to a Washington Post article published March 24, 1983, the day after President Reagan's announcement, which quoted Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy describing the proposal as reckless Star Wars schemes. SDI was forever thereafter known as Star Wars from George Lucas's popular 1977 film. The Martin Marietta Corporation, who had first released the study proposing SDI, won the first significant billion-dollar contract to take the lead in developing the Star Wars computer complex. The complex would be able to simulate strategic defense systems and evaluate how best to repel a nuclear attack. In winning the award, Martin Marietta edged out a team led by the Rockwell International Corporation. The primary purpose of the system was to unify the results of hundreds of individual tests and billions of calculations. Colonel Thomas L. Lieb, Jr., the program director of the test complex, said at the time, "It will be Martin's responsibility to simulate all the options. find the optimum mix of weapon systems, and determine whether it is cost-effective. It's a big, big job. Analysts said that the awarding of the test complex project would help propel Martin Marietta to the forefront of Strategic Defense Initiative contractors. The company was already deeply involved in the program, and in November, President Reagan visited Martin Marietta's Aerospace Center outside Denver to review the Zenith Star portion of SDI, a highly classified laser experiment planned for the early 1990s. Martin Marietta Electronics and Missiles Group in Orlando received the subcontract to continue development of an interceptor for the SDI space-based system. The interceptor is part of one of six key systems being developed for SDI. Martin Marietta Space Systems in Denver was the prime contractor for the Martin team. The Reagan administration had asked for more than $5 billion to get all elements of SDI started. Our pitches were taken up and repeated by most of us in the military-industrial complex and became more and more persuasive. President Ronald W. Reagan supported it for two reasons. He believed that the government should support the technology leaps proposed, and he very much wanted a strategic alternative to the national security policy of nuclear deterrence and mutual assured destruction that left America defenseless against Soviet missile attacks. He thought that the MAD strategy was indeed MAD. At the same time, the U.S. land-based ICBMs were growing more vulnerable to a Soviet first strike, and the United States was unable to satisfactorily field the MX missile, also renamed the Peacekeeper. These factors influenced the Joint Chiefs of Staff in February 1983 to unanimously recommend that the President begin pursuing a national security strategy with an increased emphasis on strategic defenses. In concert with the Homing Overlay Interceptor Joint Chiefs' recommendation, several prominent missile defense advocates, originally initiated by Martin Marietta Aerospace, had been persuading the President to embrace strategic defense. Consequently, on March 23, 1983, President Reagan announced his decision in a nationally televised speech to launch a major new program, SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, to determine whether or not missile defenses were technically feasible. An unexpected consequence of President Reagan's SDI speech occurred the following day, when the Washington Post quoted a critical comment from Senator Edward M. Kennedy of Massachusetts, who labeled the speech as reckless Star Wars schemes. The term Star Wars derived from the Lucas science fiction film of the same name. Senator Kennedy's remark gave the term new meaning, and SDI became widely identified thereafter as Star Wars. Star Wars is born. In April 1984, following a year of studies, the Defense Department chartered the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, SDIO, headed by U.S. Air Force Lieutenant General James A. Abrahamson. SDIO managed a consolidated and expanded missile defense program that was created largely by combining existing projects underway in several government agencies. Ultimately, SDIO's programs, which included plans for space-based missile defenses, would have required altering or possibly withdrawing from the ABM Treaty. By the autumn of 1987, SDIO had developed a national missile defense concept called the Strategic Defense System, SDS, Phase 1 Architecture, composed of a space-based interceptor, a ground-based interceptor, a ground-based sensor, two space-based sensors, and a battle management system. Using hit-to-kill interceptors, the architecture's goal was to destroy a given percentage of warheads in a massive Soviet missile attack against the United States, while improvements in its later phases would increase the system's operational effectiveness. From the outset, however, the architecture fueled controversy, since its adoption would require withdrawing from the ABM Treaty, and because its space-based component had two major shortcomings: its expense and vulnerability to Soviet anti-satellite weapons. In 1990, a new hit-to-kill interceptor concept called Brilliant Pebbles offered potential solutions to the space-based interceptor's cost and survivability issues. Brilliant Pebbles was based on many small, autonomous, space-based interceptors and replaced the original space-based interceptor concept in the SDS Phase 1 architecture. The improvement of SDIO's Phase 1 architecture with Brilliant Pebbles coincided with a shift in strategic planning. Following the opening of the Berlin Wall in November 1989, which signaled the ending of the Cold War, President George H.W. Bush ordered a review of the SDI program. The review, completed in March 1990, recommended reorienting the program to develop strategic defenses against limited attacks on the United States and theater defense against attacks by short-range ballistic missiles on overseas forces. President Bush replaces Star Wars with GPALS in January 1991. The president formally announced this new system, Global Protection Against Limited Strikes, or GPALS, in his January 1991 State of the Union address. Its principal goal was to defend America against limited missile attacks and protect deployed United States forces and America's friends and allies against shorter-range ballistic missiles. GPALS was an integrated architecture with three components: a global space-based system of Brilliant Pebbles interceptors, a force of ground and sea-based theater missile defenses, and a limited ground-based national missile defense element. President Clinton reorients missile defense, 1993. The trend toward greater emphasis on theater missile defense, also known as TMD, in this new architecture continued into the presidency of William J. Clinton, who emphasized compliance with the ABM Treaty. The Clinton administration broke up the GPALS architecture into separate components, canceled the Brilliant Pebbles program, and changed the name of SDIO to the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization, BMDO, in May 1993, as a reflection of the program's reorientation. The name change became official in June 1994. The theater missile defense portion of BMDO encompassed several Army, Navy, and Air Force programs. These included improvements in the Army's Patriot missile, known as Patriot Advanced Capability 3, or PAC-3, and a new Army missile initially known as the Theater. Also included were the Air Force's Airborne Laser Project and the lower-tier Navy Area Defense and upper-tier Navy theater-wide programs, both of which were based upon significant modifications to the shipborne Aegis Air Defense System and Standard Missile SM Interceptor. By 1996, new intelligence estimates of ballistic missile threats to America and a Republican-controlled Congress gave a new impetus to strategic missile defense, now called National Missile Defense, NMD. By the end of President Clinton's second term, NMD overshadowed theater missile defense as Congress pressed the president to deploy an NMD system with implications for altering the ABM Treaty. Consequently, in July 1999, President Clinton signed the National Missile Defense Act of 1999, which made it the policy of the United States to deploy, as soon as is technologically possible, an effective national missile defense system capable of defending the territory of the United States against limited ballistic missile attack, whether accidental, unauthorized, or deliberate. The president had four criteria for making a deployment decision. The NMD system had to be operationally effective, cost-effective, enhance U.S. security, and be in accordance with achieving arms control objectives, which included amending the ABM Treaty to accommodate a possible NMD deployment. On September 1, 2000, however, he announced that he would defer a deployment decision to his successor following a series of missile defense test failures, delays in some program elements, and a new wave of controversy over deploying an NMD system that included debate on altering the ABM treaty. President Bush reorients missile defense. 2001. Upon taking office in 2001, President George W. Bush brought to his presidency a strong commitment to deploying missile defense in the shortest possible time. On December 13, 2001, he gave Russia the six-month notice of U.S. intent to withdraw from the ABM Treaty, which became effective on June 13, 2002. Subsequently, on December 17, 2002, he issued a statement announcing the National Policy on Ballistic Missile Defense that required the Secretary of Defense to proceed with fielding an initial set of missile defense capabilities in 2004. That is as far as we need to go in the initiation of Star Wars and its fade into other programs. It is perhaps best to follow the historical events that led to Star Wars to really understand Star Wars. Star Wars came into being because the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us about as he left the presidency orchestrated the SDI program to keep the military budget high so that the complex could maintain its enriched lifestyle. Chapter 3. Historical Events Leading to SDI. We can best understand SDI and how it got so much support so quickly by taking a look at the historical events that led up to SDI. The key events could be grouped into seven categories. 1. Introduction of the ballistic missile by Germany with the V-2. 2. Introduction of the atom bomb by the United States. 3. Development of the threatening foe of communism. 4. World War II. 5. The USSR becoming a superpower. 6. The Cuban Missile Crisis. 7. The continuing threat of wars. We will discuss each in the following chapters. Chapter 4. World's First Ballistic Missile. We should probably start as far back as the dawn of the missile age in World War II. Much of this historical date was prepared by the Army, and I copy some of it in this chapter. During World War II, United States Army staff planners recognized the need for a defense system against a weapon like the German V-2, the world's first ballistic missile. At the time, there were no conventional weapons capable of combating this threat. The Germans fired their first operational V-2 with a range of about 200 miles against Great Britain on September 8, 1944. It was not very accurate and carried a limited payload. However, by the end of the war, more than 1,000 had fallen on Great Britain. They also hit targets in Belgium, France, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands. There was no defense against them, other than bombing or occupying their launch sites. It became clear that the ballistic missile would change warfare. The Germans attempted to improve the V-2 through redesign and innovation. They produced a 466-mile extended-range modified winged version, the A-4B, which was intended to glide to its target after the engine's power cut off. Although the A-4B reached the flight test stage in January 1945, it never became operational. A larger version of the V-2, called the V-9, also was conceived, but never built. It was expected to have a 375-mile range and also would glide to its target. One version of the missile included a pressurized cabin for a pilot who would have dropped the warhead on its target and returned to base using a retractable landing gear. In 1944, the Germans developed plans to attack targets in the United States with V-2s. One plan, Project Lafarens, conceived of employing an improved version of Germany's V-2. When the war in Europe ended, Germany's most ambitious plan to surpass the V-2 involved an intercontinental range missile still on the drawing board. It was a two-stage, 3,350-mile range missile called the A-9-A-10. The first stage A-10 booster would have separated at about 110-mile altitude and been recovered with the aid of special parachutes. The second stage, A-9, would then have continued under its own power to an altitude of about 215 miles before descending to 28 miles, where the density of the air would have permitted its wing controls to guide it on its final glide path to the target. The Germans also considered using a manned A-9 version, in which a pilot would have steered the missile on its final glide path, then ejected and parachuted to safety as the missile slowed down and neared its target. Some Germans believed that had the war lasted another 6 months, they would have been able to produce the A-9, A-10, and strike targets in the United States, such as New York City. Some also believed that if the war had lasted another 2 years, they would have developed a 15,000-mile range intercontinental ballistic missile, which became known as ICBM. The implications for the future were clear. Long-range ballistic missiles would pose a serious military and terror threat. A U.S. Army Ground Forces Equipment Review Board, headed by Major General Gilbert R. Cook, first recognized the need to develop a means of defending against ballistic missiles with more advanced weaponry than conventional anti-aircraft artillery. On June 20, 1945, the Cook Board submitted its report on equipment for the post-war Army that recommended high-velocity guided missiles, preferably capable of intercepting and destroying aircraft flying at speeds up to 1,000 miles per hour at altitudes up to 60,000 feet, or destroying missiles of the V-2 type, should be developed at earliest practicable date. Chapter 5. The Atom Bomb. Neither the Cook Board nor Borden's team of officers could have anticipated that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, would dramatically alter the calculus for missile defense, as the possibilities of an atomic-armed ballistic missile was quickly proved. General of the Army Henry H. Arnold, commanding general, U.S. Army Air Forces, USAAF, was in a pivotal position to influence a decision on missile defense, as his service developed and produced surface-to-air guided missiles for the Army. Although the technical challenges and costs of missile defense were clearly formidable, he championed the cause of seeking a missile defense capability in his comprehensive November 1945 report on air power and the future, which noted, "Although there now appear to be insurmountable difficulties in an active defense against future atomic projectiles similar to the German V-2, but armed with atomic explosives, this condition should only intensify our efforts to discover an effective means of defense." The following month, an Army Air Forces Scientific Advisory Group study called Toward New Horizons reflected General Arnold's vision for a future Air Force and endorsed seeking an active missile defense solution. The multi-part study suggested the possibility of using atomic-armed missile interceptors and kinetic energy, or hit-to-kill missile interceptors, among several missile defense possibilities. A January 1946 War Department Equipment Board report concurred with the earlier findings on missile defense. Headed by U.S. Army General Joseph W. Stilwell, the Stilwell Board recognized that intercontinental missiles capable of carrying atomic explosive over a range in excess of 3,000 miles are probable within the predictable future, and recommended developing an anti-aircraft missile that could intercept and destroy both high-performance aircraft and V-2-type ballistic missiles. The next step was to begin developing such a missile. Chapter 6. The Weapons of War. In March 1946, the USAAF initiated two study programs, Projects Wizard, MX-794, and Thumper, MX-795, to undertake a basic design for an anti-ballistic missile, ABM. The ABM was to operate at altitudes up to 500,000 feet against V-2-type missiles traveling between 4,000 and 5,000 miles per hour. Later, both programs broadened to include all supersonic targets flying above 60,000 feet. Initially, Wizard and Thumper planners envisioned designs for two-stage liquid-fuel interceptors armed with conventional blast fragmentation warheads. Thumper had the distinction of using the World War II German Wasserfall anti-aircraft guided missile as the basis for its design, with the possibility of later adopting an atomic warhead. These ambitious programs were significant for being the first efforts focused on seeking an active missile defense solution. In 1947, the U.S. Army Air Force, which became the U.S. Air Force that year, reviewed projects Wizard and Thumper and recognized the complex technical challenges of developing an ABM system, a task they assessed would take at least 5 to 10 years. They determined if these missile programs, as such, are supported to the maximum intelligent extent, the financial drain on the AAF program would be such as to seriously compromise the development of all other types of missiles. As a result, the Air Force subsequently combined its two ABM programs, closing Thumper in 1949 and consolidating its findings in the Wizard program, which continued on a long-term study basis. While the Air Force worked on its interceptor concept, the Army established a formal requirement for a theater ABM system in 1949. This requirement led to Project Plato in the early 1950s, the Army's first effort to develop such a system. Ever-changing requirements eventually led to Plato's replacement by a succession of systems that included the Field Army Ballistic Missile Defense System. This was known as FABMDS, the Army Air Defense System for the 1970s. AADS-70s became the Surface-to-Air Missile Development, SAMD. SAMD was ultimately renamed Phased Array Tracking Radar Intercept on Target, also known as Patriot, in honor of the 1976 U.S. Bicentennial Celebration. We at Martin Marietta Aerospace Company in Orlando won the contract to design and build the Patriot missile. As the Cold War unfolded after World War II, America determined that it faced a hostile and expansionist Soviet Union. The growing threat of Soviet long-range missiles in the 1950s posed an unprecedented challenge to defending America against attack. In 1955, intelligence reports of an impending Soviet ICBM threat spurred the Department of Defense to launch a major ballistic missile development program to match the Soviets. Several redundant, high-priority offensive missile programs were mounted by the Army, Navy, and Air Force, which blurred distinctions among the services' roles and missions. It was in this environment that the Army sought to compete with the Air Force's Project Wizard for a role in strategic missile defense. The Army had been developing several air defense missiles since the end of World War II and used this experience to initiate development in February 1957 of the nuclear-capable Nike Zeus ABM interceptor. Nike Zeus was intended to be part of an integrated defense system, which included advanced radars for acquisition and tracking and battle management communications equipment that would protect U.S. cities. From the outset, the Nike Zeus program's shortcomings and potential high costs made it a focal point of criticism and debate, notably from the Air Force and the scientific community. In the midst of this growing controversy, the Soviet Union announced a successful test flight of an SS-16 ICBM in August 1957. And on October 4, 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, the world's first artificial satellite. These catalytic events heightened concerns about American vulnerabilities to a Soviet ICBM attack and created a political environment more supportive of developing and fielding an ABM system. By early 1958, the Army and Air Force rivalry over dominance of the Strategic Missile Defense Program led Defense Secretary Neil H. McElroy to settle the dispute. On January 16, 1958, he assigned the Active Strategic Defense Mission to the Army. Later that month, a National Security Council position paper on continental defense, NSC 5802, called for an anti-ICBM weapon system as a matter of the highest national priority. Secretary McElroy also established the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA, in early 1958 to identify new means for advancing defense capabilities. In missile defense, ARPA's Project Defender took an unconventional, far-sighted approach to the perplexing problems anticipated from a mature Soviet ICBM threat in the 1970s. As one ARPA official put it, researchers were encouraged to forget about present engineering limitations and let their scientific imaginations roam wide and high. Project Defender looked beyond the capabilities of Nike Zeus and examined all phases of BMD, including the use of space-based hit-to-kill interceptors to destroy attacking missiles during their boost phase. Collectively, these interceptor concepts were known as BAMBI, for Ballistic Missile Boost Intercept. Despite its unconventional and exotic approaches to missile defense, however, Project Defender's recommendations had to be technically feasible and economically practical in meeting threats that might evolve far in the future. The October 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis brought the United States and Soviet Union close to the brink of nuclear war, when the Soviets, lacking an effective ICBM capability, placed medium and intermediate range ballistic missiles in Cuba to threaten the continental United States. The crisis inadvertently provided an impetus to the Soviets, who were forced to back down and withdraw the missiles, to aggressively improve their ICBM program. We'll cover more of this in another section on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Although Nike Zeus tests in 1962 demonstrated the system's ability to intercept enemy warheads, by early 1963, its technical and operational shortcomings scuttled it as a viable ABM system. Notable among these was the inability of the mechanically steered Nike Zeus acquisition radars to cope with the type of massive Soviet attack envisioned for the 1960s, and the inability of the system to adequately discriminate between warheads and decoys. Consequently, in January 1963, the Defense Department reoriented its ABM efforts in an improved and more robust system called Nike X. Initially, the key components of the Nike X ABM system included a new family of advanced phase array radars that could detect and track a large number of objects simultaneously, a new nuclear-armed high-acceleration terminal defense missile called the Sprint, which made possible the use of atmospheric filtering to discriminate between decoys and warheads, and the longer-range Nike Zeus interceptor, which was subsequently modified and renamed Spartan for high-altitude targets. Together, the two interceptors promised a potential layered defense for intercepting enemy warheads within and above the atmosphere. We at Martin Marietta in Orlando won the contract to design and build the Sprint missile, which was the terminal defense interceptor missile of the Nike X ABM system. The decision to develop Nike X coincided with intelligence reports that the Soviets were developing an ABM capability that could be operational by 1966. President Lyndon B. Johnson and Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara believed the best ways to counter the deployment of a Soviet ABM system was through an arms control agreement or by overcoming it with offensive weapons. They resisted calls from members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and members of Congress to match the Soviets and deploy the Nike X ABM system, which they believed would have fueled a new and expensive arms race until a different potential ballistic missile threat emerged. Following the detonation in October 1964 of Communist China's first atomic explosive, the debate over Nike X ABM system deployment began shifting in favor of a limited or thin ABM deployment to counter China, instead of a heavy ABM deployment to counter the Soviets. In 1967, Secretary McNamara settled the debate over deploying the Nike X ABM system. The failure of the Johnson administration to reach an arms control agreement with the Soviets in June 1967, and China's detonation of its first hydrogen bomb that month, influenced Secretary McNamara to announce the deployment of a thin anti-Chinese ABM system based on the Nike X system in September 1967. In November, he subsequently announced that the new ABM system would be renamed Sentinel. In 1967, the Navy and Air Force also developed ABM system concepts. The Navy examined a mid-course ABM system concept called the Sea-Based Anti-Ballistic Missile Intercept System, SABMIS, which envisioned employing radars and interceptors mounted on surface vessels and interceptors on submarines. These vessels would have been deployed in the northwestern Pacific and the North Atlantic to protect the continental United States from Soviet or Chinese attack, as well as helping defend America's allies from offshore positions. The Air Force had a similar concept called the Airborne Ballistic Missile Intercept System, ABMIS, which would have been used against low-trajectory attacks from submarine-launched ballistic missiles. ABMIS envisioned radars and interceptors mounted on specially equipped aircraft, such as the C-5A, on around-the-clock patrols adjacent to major cities overseas. In June 1968, the Johnson administration and its Senate supporters began shifting the justification for the Sentinel ABM system away from its thin urban defense against Chinese missiles and expanded its orientation towards defense of land-based ICBMs and a thick ABM system to save American lives against a large-scale Soviet attack. The shift coincided with a Soviet agreement to begin long-sought arms control negotiations and reflected the political viability of the Sentinel system as a potential arms control bargaining chip with the Soviets. This shift in rationale, however, fueled debate, criticism, and confusion over the intended purpose of the Sentinel system, which became a topic of increasing controversy. In 1969, President Richard M. Nixon, responding partly to the public backlash over locating nuclear-armed missiles near urban areas, reoriented the Sentinel ABM system away from urban defense to protecting the nation's strategic deterrent silo-based Minuteman ICBMs against a Soviet attack. Emphasizing this reorientation, President Nixon renamed the system Safeguard. This anti-ballistic missile system was constructed over 8 years for approximately $6 billion and operational for not more than 3 days. Upon closure, the giant tunnels beneath were flooded with water. The Safeguard program was developed in the 1960s to shoot down incoming Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles. The site was a massive complex of missile silos, a giant pyramid-shaped radar system, and dozens of launching silos for surface-to-air missiles tipped with thermonuclear warheads. However, due to its expense and concern over both its effectiveness and the danger of detonating defensive nuclear warheads over friendly territory, the program was shut down. Today, it is a military-industrial shell in the middle of nowhere, or in the words of one writer, a monument to man's fear and ignorance. Although controversy continued over deploying the ABM system, Safeguard became an important bargaining chip during arms control negotiations with the Soviets, the Strategic Arms Limitation Talks, also known as SALT. Initially, there were to have been up to 12 Safeguard sites deployed in phases, depending on how well talks with the Soviets proceeded. In May 1972, arms control talks with the Soviets produced the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, or ABM Treaty, which restricted the deployment of any strategic space-based, sea-based, or mobile ABM systems, such as SABMIS and ABMIS. The treaty allowed each side only two fixed missile defense sites, one to defend national command authorities and one to defend a missile field, with no more than 100 total interceptors for both sites. A 1974 protocol subsequently reduced the number of sites to one, still allowing up to 100 interceptors. Since the United States was already deploying Safeguard to protect an ICBM field at Grand Forks Air Force Base in North Dakota, this was the only U.S. ABM site allowed until June 2002, when the U.S. withdrew from the ABM treaty. Having served its purpose as a political bargaining chip, the Safeguard site at Grand Forks was only operational from October 1975 to February 1976. The site was closed at the direction of Congress because it could be easily overwhelmed by a Soviet attack and because it had a major technical problem. The detonation of its nuclear-armed warheads would blind its own radars. By the late 1970s, the continued growth in the quantity and quality of Soviet ICBMs, which included impressive accuracy improvements in the SS-18 missile, threatened the survivability of U.S. land-based ICBMs. At the same time, the United States was unable to find a politically acceptable, secure basing mode for its next-generation ICBM, the MX. These circumstances prompted U.S. strategic planners to revisit the possibilities of deploying a missile defense system for its land-based ICBM force with non-nuclear interceptors. The Army had been working on developing a non-nuclear hit-to-kill interceptor prior to the deployment of Safeguard. It held a series of tests in 1983 and 1984 called the Homing Overlay Experiment, HOE, to demonstrate this capability. On June 10, 1984, in the last of four tests, an HOE vehicle successfully intercepted a dummy warhead outside the atmosphere in the first successful demonstration of hit-to-kill technology in space. While the Army continued its BMD research and development, ARPA's successor, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, formed the Directed Energy Office in 1980 to exploit newly emerging laser and particle beam technologies for applications that included BMD. The office initiated the Space Defense Triad Program, composed of three separate research projects, with an objective of determining the feasibility by 1988 of developing a space-based laser battle station that could target Soviet ICBM launch sites. DARPA also envisioned possible ground-based and space-based particle beam weapons for terminal defense and boost or mid-course defense, respectively. Chapter 7. The Communist Foe. Russia's adaptation of communism introduced a major new foe that threatened democracy and led to the Cold War. To better understand the Cold War, we need to review a bit of history. Almost all of Europe had been kingdoms or tsardoms. Russia was a tsardom, which is about the same as a kingdom. Nicholas II was the last Russian tsar and ruled until his abdication in March 1917. A provisional government took power, but was overthrown in the 1917 October Revolution led by the Marxist leader Vladimir Lenin. Russia